Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 420 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 1st of March 2019, as I record this. So today I'm talking to Sasha Black about writing heroes and villains. So listen out for writing tips as well as a discussion on what it feels like to be an author who is not quite just beginning and not quite made it yet. I thought I'd ask Sasha about that. So we talk about that as well. In publishing news, it seems to be going off this week. So first of all, really good news in the global publishing space. And I love to read the newpublishingstandard.com, which is a fantastic blog about what's going on in the world outside of America. Because after all, it's not all about the US and it's not all about Amazon. Now, Streetlib, who are an international publisher, I guess they're an international site publisher, publishing site. They have just launched author and publisher portals in 22 African nations, plus another one in the Caribbean and also in Oceania, taking its total to 45 countries that people can publish in. In early March, Streetlib will complete its rollout across the African continent, providing an author and publisher portal to every African nation. And this includes countries that US-based companies might not support. So this is fantastic. And they also say we need to keep up with the pace of global change. Today, there are more people online in Africa than there are in North America, Latin America, or the EU. Kenya, for example, has more people online than Spain. Nigeria has more people online than the UK or Germany. And my sister-in-law is Nigerian, as I've said before, and I know much more about Nigeria these days. And it is, an incredible country, so much going on there in terms of entrepreneurial people and, also a big country, a lot of English speakers. So fascinating to see. Oh, and the fastest growing economy in Africa and one of the world's fastest growing economies, I believe. So really interesting stuff there from Streetlib. They also say while books in all languages, including indigenous African languages, can be uploaded, not all languages are supported by retailer and library partners. For example, Amazon only supports one African language, Afrikaans, spoken in South Africa. To solve that problem, we have the Streetlib International Store, where, appropriately, in the UNESCO Year of Indigenous Languages, books in all languages can be uploaded and sold, and anyone anywhere in the world can buy from in multiple currencies. And if you think about it, that is incredible. I just think that's so brilliant, and hats off to Streetlib, because to say that they're going to support all African indigenous languages, and I presume they're going to look at rolling this out to other places in the world, that's pretty incredible. So good on Streetlib. I'll put the link to the in the show notes as ever, but you can always check out thenewpublishingstandard.com for all this type of global news. And thanks to Mark there for collecting all of that every day as he does. And Mark, the guy who does New Publishing Standard, he's actually based in Africa, so he's well placed to report on that. Other publishing news, new public beta from Draft Digital, which now distributes to Google Play. And if you log in to Draft Digital, you'll now get prompted as to whether or not you want to opt in for Google Play. So good on D2D for sorting out Google Play access. I use Publish Drive for Google Play and have done for, I guess, almost a year now. And Publish Drive also has a press release today as well for enhanced Amazon ads. So last month, I reported and Publish Drive announced a built-in Amazon advertising tool to the Publish Drive dashboard board, and now they have updated it with advanced targeting options using their proprietary AI technology. And together, these updates will help authors reduce costs from unwanted clicks and improve campaign performance. Now, you can use the ANS platform even if you don't have Amazon Books through Publish Drive, but of course, you do need an account. So you can set up an account and try their ANS platform. Again, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Publish Drive are also sponsoring the show today, so you'll be hearing some more from them in a minute. And then finally, more in the publishing and book marketing space, Readzy have announced Readzy Discovery, a new service that aims to give exposure to the rising number of indie books published each year. Readzy Discovery will promote indie books through a community of expert reviewers and reader feedback. Members can browse curated bookshelves, preview chapters, and connect with book lovers. In addition to an innovative feed of fresh discoveries, Readzy Discovery will feature a weekly newsletter. Yes, hand-picked suggestions straight from trustworthy reviewers and a leaderboard that lets readers upvote their favourite titles, which is kind of similar to the idea of product hunt for books, a product hunt obviously being for apps and other things, but really interesting to see Readzy doing this because, of course, Readzy are really very good at SEO and also content marketing, and they have been building an email list of readers. So this is definitely worth checking out if you want to get in front of more readers. They have some sort of clearly very popular genres starting out, and over time they'll add more. As I am an affiliate of Readzy and think they are fantastic, they focus very much on the curation, high-level curation, which I think is missing in a lot of things. But you can check it out through my link, thecreativepen.com/discovery. And yeah, you can have a look at that. It's definitely something I'm going to be doing once they have my genres in there. So in my personal update this week, I have broken 20,000 words on the new Matt Walker dark fantasy novel, which I'm really pleased about. Once I get to 20,000 words, I have much more of a clue as to what I'm doing. Although, of course, as a discovery writer or a pantser, I guess, I never know what's really going to happen. I had thought I had an idea for book three, but I think I'm going to put it in this book. Never save anything. I think that is something that comes through in a lot of writers' tips. Never save your ideas, you know, put everything you can into the book you're writing. Another little tip which I remembered because another character appeared to me and I wrote the scene with this new character, and then I realised that once again I'd given them a name with exactly the same letter as a whole load of other people. And this is another great tip. If you're writing fiction, list out your characters in alphabetical order and check you don't have characters that start with the same letter or that sound the same. Remember the tip from with audio narration, as I've mentioned, you want to make sure that your reader can distinguish between the characters. And I've definitely made this mistake. So always worth making an alphabetical list of your characters. And you will, I think we all just have a default sort of letter or name that we go to. And so it really helps to, and maybe it's because my name begins with J, but I often have names beginning with J. I have also been finishing off the initial material for the new site, which I will reveal in two shows' time on the 18th of March, which will be my 10th anniversary show for the Creative Pen. And once again, I'm not closing down this podcast. I'm just starting a new one as well. Glutton for punishment. Clearly. But you'll see if you are interested in checking that out, that it will be quite different to this one. That was the other thing. I got my first $30 income from Findaway Voices. Now, getting $30 in the first month from a new vendor, I think pretty cool. I mean, if you're just starting out, you'll probably be just as excited as I am about $30. Now, of course, I'm not starting out, but whenever I add a new stream of income, I get really happy because for me, that represents the beginning of this stream, which if I keep producing more audio, which I'm intending to, that stream will grow. And I know from my other audiobooks that it can be a seriously good stream of income for audio. Also, what was interesting is I had a look at the report from Findaway. So I know it's only $30 and over time I'll have more data, but that consists of some library borrows in the US and in Australia, purchases of the audiobook on Google Play, and also borrows on Scribd and HiBooks. So the Scribd and HiBooks, that's a pool amount. So basically people pay a subscription. I guess it's a bit like Kindle Unlimited, really, except it's non-exclusive. And this is the thing, I have absolutely no problem with subscription services. I have a problem with exclusivity. I would be straight into KU, Kindle Unlimited, with my books if it was non-exclusive. But of course, it's exclusive, so I'm not. But this is really exciting because, as I said, $30 month one. Woohoo! Got to get excited about more streams of income. So thanks for all your emails and tweets this week. Quite a lot of people telling me that they enjoyed my in-betweenisode about why you should narrate your fiction. And also lots of people telling me very nice things about my narration. Also a lot of comments that my narration voice for JF Penn is very different to my chatty Joanna Penn voice. And I think that's just part of it. I mean, part of the point of narration is that your voice disappears. It's not a conversation, it's reading. The words should be stronger than the voice as such. And I'm not really making sense there, but you know what I mean? My voice should disappear with the narration. You should just get used to it and listen to the story. Whereas here, you're learning more. It's not rehearsed as such. It's quite different. So a couple of people saying, Shalina said, glad you did the in-betweenisode, listened while walking my dog Cookie. I've been preparing to do the audio for my own fiction. I'm taking your approach to learning how to do more with my voice before I begin, in order to give my listening audience the best I can. Thank you, Shalina. Julie says, your audio recordings of your fiction are captivating. We're set for a snowstorm this weekend and I can see listening to you read while I'm watching the snow in front of a fire. Please consider this a huzzah to keep recording your fiction. Thank you, Julie. Kim says, I'm a new author and found your podcast incredibly helpful. I listen to it on my drive to work, where I'm a reading tutor at a very busy public library. Thank you, Kim, and thanks for your service in the library. That sounds fantastically helpful. Yes, Emily said, I've just listened to the intro of episode 419 for the third time. One sentence really resonated. The creative struggle is the point. I'm a full-time writer working on my 23rd book, and lately it's been a struggle. I've been wondering why the heck I'm doing this. And then you said the magic words, the creative struggle is the point. I needed to remind myself of that. Oh, thank you, Emily. And I know the feeling. I mean, I've felt with this novel in the last couple of weeks, like, oh, goodness me, this is hard work. But then it's like, as we said, the hard work is the point. Just a couple more. Tenzin says, now I know the difference between ghostwriters and pen names, and have often wondered about this and misunderstood ghostwriters as the pen name. Glad that helped, Tenzin. And finally, Michelle says, enjoyed the podcast. Your narrating is so different to your casual banter. Looking forward to hearing progress with time. Yeah, it is definitely different. So thanks as ever to everyone commenting on the show. And you can always leave a comment on the show notes. You can go to thecreativepen.com/podcast and find the episode and leave a comment. You can also tweet me at thecreativepen. I am on Instagram at JFPenAuthor, but I don't really do comments on there. I'm not very good at doing Instagram. I'm good at putting pictures up. I'm just not so good at sort of typing. Oh, we can't do everything, can we? Right, so where are we? Let me see where we are in my notes. Right. Today's show is sponsored by Publish Drive, which I primarily use for Google Play, as well as Chinese and Eastern European ebook stores. And again, Publish Drive is another income stream that I've added in the last year. So always love to do that. I will play a word from Publish Drive in a minute. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription and the editing, but my time in creating the show is sponsored by my patrons. So thanks as ever to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Cheryl Marlene, Michael Finn, Paul Goh, Molly Totoro, and Rachel Smith. I really appreciate your support on Patreon. Like the tweets and emails, it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And remember, you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you're feeling generous, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, including the backlist. So lots more audio help if you are interested. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from Publish Drive, and then we'll get on with the interview.
Hey everyone, Adam here with Publish Drive. The writing process is hard enough, so the publishing and marketing process should be easier. We here at Publish Drive help authors write more, publish more, sell more, and worry less. So, if you're an aspiring author, a new author, or even an experienced pro, here are five marketing tools to help you sell more books, all built in to the Publish Drive platform. Tool number one, reach more readers by going wide in your distribution. Get your titles in front of as many people as possible. Here at Publish Drive, we help authors distribute ebooks to over 400 stores worldwide, including Amazon, Google Play, Apple Books, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, and many other retailers throughout the world. And now, even in China. Number two, use Publish Drive's free review copy tool to boost your number of book reviews. Tool number three, get your book listed and featured on the front page of retailers like Apple Books, Kobo, and others with Publish Drive's free featuring tool. Number four, share your story and success with us so it will appear on more social media channels through our free social tool. And lastly, marketing tool number five, boost the effectiveness of your Amazon ads with Publish Drive's built-in enhanced Amazon advertising tool. Skip the learning curve and use our platform to get the most out of your ads. Like I said, the writing process is hard enough, so the publishing and marketing process should be easier. We here at Publish Drive help authors write more, publish more, sell more, and worry less. So check us out at publishdrive.com.
Today, I'm here with Sasha Black. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, Joanna. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Sasha is a best-selling YA fantasy author and also writes non-fiction for writers, including 13 Steps to Evil and 10 Steps to Hero on creating characters. She's also a blogger, writing coach, and developmental editor. So, Sasha, just tell us a bit more about you and how you got into writing and publishing.
So I think if I'd been slightly more self-aware, I probably would have started writing slightly younger. I always read as a kid. I kind of had to change libraries because I literally devoured entire kids sections. And sort of similarly, I wrote stories as well. But I also grew up knowing I had to get a proper job. So, you know, instead of going to university and, I don't know, doing creative writing or whatever, I went and did psychology. And after that, I ended up in a fast track management scheme. So kind of corporate hellmare, as I like to call it. And so I became sort of more and more stifled, and I needed an outlet. So I created a pen name, which is where Sasha Black comes from. And I started ranting on a blog. Literally, that's what I was doing. But the blogging community is so wonderful, and I met lots of people, and I discovered flash fiction. That sort of led one thing to another, and I dug out my old sort of notebooks, and my first young adult fantasy book genuinely is a character that I created when I was 9 years old.
Cool.
So she's been with me for a very long time. And then I started writing up lessons that I'd learned because I wanted a place. I'm basically senile. So I needed somewhere to put these sort of writing craft lectures that I'd learned and lessons. And a few of them, particularly on villains, they didn't go viral, but I saw an awful lot of traffic very quickly. And so I did a bit of investigating. I looked on Amazon. I discovered there was very few books on villains. And so I figured there was a market there. And that is basically history. It just sort of spiraled from there.
No, that's really cool. We're going to come back to the blogging, I think. But I want to just, so the development from flash fiction into a full YA novel, that's quite a leap, isn't it? Because if people don't know, flash fiction's what, 500 words, 1,000 words. So how did you make that leap then from writing flash and writing kind of non-fiction blog posts to full YA? Because I know that's a leap that a lot of people want to make.
It was less a leap, more a snail's crawl to writing the book. So I did a very typical thing of somebody who is afraid to start writing. And for an entire year, I plotted, I looked at visual things, I wrote notes, I changed my plot. And after a year, this was sort of the year that I was pregnant. And when my son was born, I knew I had to be the person that followed their dreams, because that's the role model that I wanted to be for him. So I heard about Nano and I just sort of said a rude word and just went for it, you know? So I took the notes and decided that I had to start or I was never going to start. And the Nano Remote Challenge, for anybody that doesn't know, is 50,000 words in a month. And I figured it was as good of a challenge with accountability. Sort of, you've got these public sort of forums and word counts. And I didn't look back.
How many words did you do in that Nano?
52,000 or 57,000. I threw the entire thing away.
So what did it give you then? What did it give you?
The habit. It gave me the habit of writing. And that was all it took, really. I drove my wife insane because she couldn't stand the tapping for the entire month. She's used to it now. But so after the month, I'd got the habit. It was an itch. I had to keep scratching. I had to keep creating. And the nonfiction blogs just weren't enough anymore. I wanted to do both. So I wrote another entire draft, which I also binned. And excuse me, after that, I changed my process and I decided that I was going to get feedback after every single chapter so that I didn't make plot mistakes going through. I intensively studied the craft, and that third draft did go to a publication. So I think in total, I wrote 270,000 words of my first book, which ended up at about 64 or something.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, there's a few things there. My first Nano, which is how I got started, I did like around 20,000 words, and around 5,000 of that made it into the book. But also, I think it's interesting because a lot of us feel like the third novel is where you start to kind of understand things. So you just did it all in one. You did it all in one. Which is hilarious. And the other thing you were saying there, my husband also says, like, when there's the tap, tap, tapping sound, he's like, oh, that's the sound of my wife. Yeah. So, which is quite funny. But okay, let's get into the books and give some people some tips. And I do think your psychology stuff obviously comes into the books. So let's talk about villains. Why do all stories need a good villain, even if we're writing a happy, happy rainbows, unicorns romance?
Okay, so excuse me. I think it's universally accepted that stories are about change. Whether it's your hero that's changing through a character arc, or if it's the world, a kind of dystopian novel that's crumbling, the story is about change. But another word for change is conflict. And I kind of make it a bit sciencey here, but I think that Darwin was absolutely correct in that it is about survival of the fittest, and that applies to our characters as well. So you only really change, I think, when you are pushed to your absolute limits. That is when you're out of your comfort zone and you have to basically adapt or die, as Darwin would say. And your villain, in whatever guise that may be, is generally the source of that conflict. Obviously, you have different types of villains, whether it be an antagonist or, you know, inner conflict or whatever in a literary novel. But you know, broadly speaking, your villain is the source of that conflict. They put obstacles in the way of your hero, and they force your hero to make do or die decisions. And that is why you need a villain. So it doesn't matter which genre you're in. The thing that they all have in common is that the villains are the source of conflict.
Mm. And if we don't have conflict, it's just happy people in happy land, which I think James Scott Bell said that. And it always makes me laugh. It's like, yeah, that's not a story. That's just boring.
Nobody cares. Where's the grit? Where's the drama?
Yeah, where's the conflict, which is exactly right. So how do then we construct a good villain with depth that it does not, is not cliche, but it's also good enough? I was reading some of my diaries and I found a thing about one of the Bond films. It was, why was this not a good Bond film? I can't remember which one it was. And it was like that the villain wasn't good enough. The villain wasn't, I wasn't scared. There wasn't enough of a threat in a good Bond film. There has to be a big threat. But so how do we construct a good villain with depth?
Okay, so I think the key to a good villain is a villain who is both credible and believable. And there's a few different things and sort of tactics and plot devices that you can use in order to create that credibility and believability. So the most obvious one that I think everybody would know is for your villain as well as your hero to have a very, very solid motive. Everybody, I don't care who you are, even if you are a serial killer, has a reason why they do things. It is psychology 101. It's human nature. Even in horror films like Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy Krueger even has a reason why he wants revenge. You know, he was locked in a burning building. So that's number one. Number two would be morals and values. So having a moral or a value, even when you're a villain, gives them a valid reason. It justifies their behavior. It justifies their why. So I always think that is sort of the second stage of having a motive. The third one that I would say is for your villain to have something in their past, whether it be a wound or a scar that something emotionally wounding or that's created sort of an emotional scar in their psychology that is driving their behavior, because that's kind of connected into the motive. I've lost count. Possibly number four would be villain. You know, there's that really cheesy phrase, even villains have mummies, but it's actually really true. And I think if you give your villain a redeeming quality, or alternatively, if you don't sort of want to give them a redeeming quality, you can give them something to love that humanizes them. And that sort of humanity makes them more relatable. And that's how you get them to connect with a reader. So just a couple of examples, even Lord Voldemort from Harry Potter had his pet snake Nagini. So, even your sort of everybody must die type villains have that sort of humanity in them.
Mm. And it's really interesting. You brought to mind when you said even villains have mummies, you brought to mind that we need to talk about Kevin, which I think it would be classed as a literary novel. And, you know, it's about a kid who kills his school, not friends, but people at school. But it's his mother. You know, you really have, you feel empathetic towards him, where he is, I guess he's really the villain and it's her story, but it's one of those complicated things. You have to be able to make your villain empathetic in some way. And another question, do any villains really believe they are the baddies?
Well, no, absolutely not. And that's the reason for having values, is that it makes, excuse me, having a value gives them this unfaltering logic to their sort of their crazy, I call it, you know, their sort of reason, their big campaign, their thing that they're trying to destroy or whatever. Having a value in their mind will justify their actions. And there's a great example of that, President Snow from The Hunger Games. He he has this sort of rule that he tells Katniss that I only ever kill for a purpose. That's a value, and that justifies his behavior. He believes what he's doing. He kills, yes, but he only kills for a reason. And that automatically makes you as a reader sort of invest in what they're saying.
Mm. Yeah, it's really interesting. I just started writing another novel this morning as we talk, which is kind of hilarious. And my baddies, you know, want to take our land back. And it's interesting because borders are this area where everyone thinks they're in the right, you know, whose land is it anyway type of question. And this type of thing always comes up for me. Who is the villain in these type of stories? And then this kind of plays into the idea of theme. So how do we construct a good villain that also plays into the theme of the story? Or how do we even strengthen theme with villains?
So I think that I can't think of the word, but it's, you know, like a distraction sometimes thinking about hero, villain and theme. I think all characters play into theme. I think it themes this weird concept that loads of writers panic about and worry about. Not everybody knows what their theme is when you first start writing. Some people don't know until the final draft. But if you have a character arc and if you have change, I can guarantee you have a theme buried in there somewhere. So I personally like to think about theme in terms of a psychological theory. I told you it would come into play. So there's somebody called Gestalt. I forget the year, 1950 something or other. And it's a psychological theory that basically says the whole is more than the sum of its parts. Now, I liken that to a novel and similarly to a spider's web. I think all novels are spider's webs, and I call it something called the web of connectivity. Each thread in a spider's web is its own unique thread. But when you step back and you look at the whole of the threads, it's more than just a series of threads. It's an entire web, or in our case, an entire novel. And that stands for things like plots, plot twists, characters, subplots, you know, so on and so forth. So how does that connect to villain? If you want to strengthen your theme, I put all of my characters on a continuum. So if you have the full embodiment of your theme, that is your hero. If you want the full embodiment of the sort of antithesis, the opposite of your theme, that is your villain. But to strengthen that, you should look at every single character and how they reflect the theme. So leading on with the Katniss and the Hunger Games example, Katniss embodies the theme of sacrifice. President Snow embodies the theme of sacrificing everybody else for his own good. And that plays out by him obviously sacrificing tributes, these kids who have to go and fight each other. And so on and so forth. The other characters like Peter and Rue are all variations on sacrifice. Even Haymitch, who's sort of this anti-hero mentor character, he is sort of the reluctant sacrificer. But he comes round in the end, and he sort of gives medicine and things to Katniss during the game. So as well as looking at the villain and as embodying and all of his actions being the anti-side to your theme, look at the other characters too, and how you can reflect theme in their actions, and what question are they answering about the theme? How can they embody different variations, different points on the continuum?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think I'm a bit more of a writing into the dark type person. And I mean, I know my Matt Walker series, the theme is borders and maps and, you know, where the lines are between us as people and all that. But it's interesting when you say that, and I start to see how I think maybe we naturally, as we're readers, we construct these things. So if people are listening going, wow, that's quite reductionist. Well, you know, you can do it either way. You can kind of reverse engineer later, or you can, work through a workbook like yours, which we're going to come back to in a minute. So let's talk about heroes, because I actually find villains super easy. Like, I really enjoy writing my bad people, and I very often I just don't struggle at all to find empathy with my villains, but I do struggle with my heroes. I feel that I struggle much more with that. And they're almost me. Generally, they are almost me, my main characters. And so maybe that's why it's a problem. But how do we construct a hero who is not just cardboard cutouts?
So I talk about something called the hero lens, which is essentially the concept that everything your reader experiences should be funneled through your hero. They shouldn't come into contact with anything that isn't relevant to what your hero is directly experiencing. And that kind of is categorized for me into four different things. So actions, thoughts, feelings, dialogue. The rest of the story, obviously describing things is really important. You need to locate your reader. You need to put them in time and space. But so what? Your reader doesn't really care. All that does is create a picture in their head. If you want to make your reader care, your reader wants to know, what does your hero feel? What do they think about the fact that it's cold on the train and the train's in disrepair or whatever? That's a terrible example, but you know what I mean. excuse me. When you share that inner psyche and that inner viewpoint with the reader, that's what makes your hero relatable, and that's what helps your reader to connect with your, I nearly said villain, that's because I love villains too. That's what makes them connect with your hero. So let me ask you a question. This is a bit random, but, and I always use this question. I've said this so many times, but is turquoise more blue or more green?
Blue, absolutely. I just took off my turquoise jumper.
Okay, but I guarantee that half of the people listening to this would have said green. And that's what makes your hero unique. It's not motives or traits. Everybody has a motive. Everybody has a trait. What's unique about your hero and what makes your reader fall in love with your hero is their particular perspective, their sort of your hero's rose-tinted glasses. How does your hero's thoughts, feelings, and actions impact how they view the surroundings? So I kind of draw that down to saying, if you want to imbue that in your story, go think about how your hero's viewpoints affect your sentences at sentence level. So if your hero's angry, you know, you have to use shorter, sharper words. If your hero's depressed, you know, make your sentences longer. They flow, they're more melancholy. So that's one thing. Second thing, layer conflict, really important. There's kind of three different types of conflict. Inner conflict, which is your great example of this, Ned Stark. I don't know if you're a Game of Thrones fan.
Of course.
I'm going to Dubrovnik this year.
No spoilers.
So Ned Stark is completely out of context, a character, and George Martin does this quite a lot with his characters. He pits their values against each other and makes them sort of butt against each other and have to make really difficult decisions. So a difficult decision very early on for Ned Stark is he values loyalty, but he also is very intelligent and has a lot of foresight. His decision is he's been asked to go and help the king. If he goes and helps the king, he's pretty sure he's probably not going to come back, you know, and that creates this inner conflict. Does he go and help the king, which he should because he's his friend and wants to? But if he does, he kind of knows it might be his end. So that creates inner conflict. A second layer of conflict is sort of your micro conflict, characters fighting against each other, hero, villain, blah, blah, blah. And then your third layer of conflict is macro. So society, world, war. And if you, obviously they're perhaps very fantasy type examples, but you can layer these levels of conflict, and that helps to create barriers and problems for your hero to fight against. And the very last point is the bravery myth. So I think lots of writers think that the way you get your readers to connect is to make your hero brave. Well, I would beg to differ. I think you make your readers, I know everybody can be brave, you know, so it just takes a bit of balls. Sorry, I say that, guts, you know, but it's the hero who sacrifices something that really shines. And usually the sacrifice has to be something that's important. The more important the sacrifice, the more valuable and the more engaged your readers become. Especially, you know, typically it's something about themselves that they have to give up or sacrifice, you know, to overcome their inner flaw. So those are probably the three things that I would say are most beneficial for your hero.
Yeah, and it's interesting bringing up Game of Thrones, and as we speak the final series is not yet out, and which is like, oh my goodness. But I read the first couple of books and then I went off the books, but the TV series is masterful in conflict. And also I think, you know, as you're saying with heroes and villains, half the time you don't know who's a hero and who's a villain, and that's clever, that's super super clever, and the all these different layers of conflict also. So yeah, I would say Game of Thrones, even if you don't like fantasy, you can watch Game of Thrones and understand this idea of conflict like on every page. It's just incredible. Okay, so let's talk about some of your publishing things, because I'm very interested. I mean, obviously I have workbooks for my books. You have these workbook editions for your hero and your villain books. So I wonder, you know, why did you want to do workbooks? Is it worth it for multiple streams of income? Any tips for other people on workbooks?
Okay, so completely honest, why did I do them? Because you do. No, okay, that was one of the reasons. The other reason is because I do actually use them, and KM Whalen has some workbooks too, and I used hers and I actually really enjoyed them, and I found them more useful sometimes than the textbook. So it was sort of a combination of seeing the value that you'd sort of promoted of having them, and lastly, because it makes good business sense. Now, I actually went and checked what my sales were yesterday because I knew this question was coming. And so I have digital workbooks. So I have ebooks, I have paperbacks, and I also have box sets. So I've digitally box setted the pair, and I will paperback it. It's just slotted into, you know, production schedules. Each one of those is earning me between 6 and 10% on top of every textbook sale. So every 1 in 10 will also buy a workbook, or they'll buy the box set. Now, that might not seem like very much, but when you have sort of 6 or 12 or 20 of these workbooks, all of these little 6%, all of these 10%, suddenly you are making a lot of money. So the other thing is that it takes the pressure off having to have one book that is this golden egg that earns you all the money. I'm not really interested in, well, no, obviously I am interested in that, but you know, it's a much easier business strategy to have lots and lots of different products. So that was, you know, one of the main reasons for doing it. In terms of tips, there are lots of different ways you can make up a workbook. I generally do summaries of my core textbook chapters that give enough information that they're comprehensive without giving all of the information from the textbook, for obvious reasons. And when I am writing the textbook, I actually note down questions at the same time, which is silly because essentially I'm writing two books at once. But it also means that when I finish the textbook, it only takes me a day to sort of mock up the workbook. So I would say that is probably the first thing. Write the questions as you go, because the questions should hopefully come to mind. Vellum for formatting. It is hard to get vellum to leave you spaces. So if you can't get vellum, then pay somebody to format it, because obviously workbooks, you do need space for people to write their answers. And do digital versions, because I was kind of skeptical of doing them at first, because I thought, oh, well, everybody will want a workbook so they can write the answers in it. But actually, that's not the case. I am earning just as much, if not more, from my digital workbooks than I am from the paperbacks. And I think it's possibly for the same reasons that or how I use my own workbooks from other authors, in that I don't write in them, I preserve them so that I can use them again and again. So having a digital version is, you know, essentially the same. You just, instead of having a paperback, you reuse the same ebook. So do digital versions, definitely.
Oh, well, see, I haven't done digital versions of my workbooks because...
missing out.
Yeah, because I guess, as you say, you think, oh, no one would, why would you, you know, why wouldn't you just get the book? I mean, I include all the questions in the main book. So if people want to kind of write them in their journals or whatever, they can do that. But it's interesting, I have been using an iPad a lot more, using an app called iAnnotate on PDFs. So I wonder, that's another way, isn't it? You could basically open up the workbook in a on more of a tablet and kind of fill it in. And a lot of people have styluses now, I guess. So good tip. Good tip there. That's fantastic. Oh, and what size are you doing? 6x9 or?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Are you
slightly bigger, so they have more space to write.
Yeah, exactly. So I also wanted to ask you, because you have two nonfiction books and the workbook editions, obviously you have two novels, you've got a blog. So you're not newbie. You're not just starting out. You know what you're doing, but you're not, you know, someone who's super famous for making seven figures a year, which, let's face it, I'm not either. So any thoughts for people who are where you are, which is, you know what you're doing, but you feel perhaps that you have somewhere to go at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. I am not writing full time. I definitely have somewhere to go. Now, I love this question because it made me stop and kind of reflect. So technically, I've only been published for 17 months. So I haven't even been published for 2 years. So when I thought about that, I was like, wow, it's been a long 17 months, you know? I can't believe how much I've done. And sort of every day I moan that I haven't done enough. But no, okay, so what are the lessons that I've learned? First of all, everybody's situation is different. I have never come across two authors who have got to full time by doing it the same way. So the first one is to find your own way, find your own method. Second lesson I've learned is to get your finances in order. I think it's Elizabeth Gilbert who says you don't want your love for creating to have to pay your bills in kind of the giving you that pressure. So clear off debt, make sure you have a nest egg. That would be number two. Number three would be to negotiate a slow reduction. I've been listening to the 4-Hour Work Week audiobook, and something clicked recently in that lots of people think that their employers aren't very flexible. But actually, have you asked? Have you actually asked? Because I bet you they are more flexible than you think they are. So asking and negotiating for flexible working and reducing your hours slowly, I think, is really positive. That said, I'm a complete hypocrite because everything that I'd reduced up until now was kind of play money. It was just sort of saving money that I would have saved, and instead I took the time to write. And recently, I've taken on a lot of freelance work. I've got a lot more projects going, and I cannot. Do the hours that I'm doing in my day job if I want to take this seriously. And I stalled and I couldn't reduce my hours anymore. Anyway, I've done it. But sometimes you have to be brave and take the risk. Otherwise, you're going to stay in the same place. And I do not want to stay in the same place. What else? Network. It's invaluable. And don't be afraid to ask. So I have met so many authors who are just so kind and so willing to help. And I was so afraid to talk to anybody, you know, that sort of first London book fair. And everybody's lovely, you know, and the opportunities that come out of networking are ample. So I would say definitely network. In terms of marketing, pay to play, unfortunately. And as much as I find it difficult and grueling to kind of do slow burn ads, I try to do a mixture of sort of daily AMS ads, you know, a few sprinkled with a few BookBub CPM ads, as well as trying to do some spike marketing as well. And I think that gives me quite a good mix and is building kind of both my readership and my sales slowly. And I'm happy with that because it makes it stable. Last one, Jack Canfield, who I read because of you. Thank you. Oh my gosh, it was amazing. I have signed a contract to myself with a leaving date that I publicly tell people a lot because it makes me get accountable for it. So, and I keep it in my wallet. And I think every single time I go to buy a coffee, or, you know, I see that note and it makes me, it reminds me to keep fighting every day. So.
Oh, that's fantastic. And that book is The Success Principles by Jack Canfield, which I listened to or read over 10 years ago when I was looking at leaving. And I also had the bit of paper in my wallet, which, my bit of paper said, I am creative. I am an author. A long time before I was creative or an author. So these things work. And also I went to 4 days a week. That's what I did also, the dialing down, and we downsized and sold everything. And so all of this stuff is exactly right. And I'm glad you've got a date. So let's circle back to blogging, because of course you mentioned a whole load of marketing stuff then, but you didn't mention blogging. And I mean, I'm starting a new blog, a new podcast, so I'm still a massive believer in content marketing. But you also helped me with Instagram, which you also didn't mention. So any thoughts on blogging or Instagram and or Instagram for marketing or brand building?
So my blog is very much for my nonfiction audience. I haven't quite worked out how to do the blogging thing for my fantasy stuff, but actually that's what I'm using Instagram for. My blog has garnered me basically all of my subscribers for my nonfiction. It's how I created an audience. And I feel terrible, but I kind of did it by accident. It was like the least of all of the things I've done. That was the least intentional. But it's a great way, because nonfiction is about solving problems. And I blogged my lessons, which were essentially solving writing problems. And I sort of shared them on Pinterest and different social media channels. And that's how I gained a nonfiction audience. On Instagram, I started because, for a really shallow reason, I'm really visual and the book pictures are so pretty. And I really liked them, and I wanted book pictures of my books to look like that. So that's how it started. But actually, I find Instagram amazing, because one of the biggest problems for fiction writers is visibility. But Instagram has this ginormous Bookstagram community, and they're all whale readers. They're all reading like 100 books a year. Who can read 100 books a year? These people do, I'm telling you. This visibility problem is a problem because you don't know how to find them. But on Instagram, all you have to do is go in and sort of hashtag, search by hashtag YA fantasy or whatever. And all of a sudden there's 400,000 people who are fantasy readers, and they're all engaged. And Instagram has all of these quirky ways of being able to interact with people in your stories. You can ask questions. You can play bits of music. You can insert polls. And I found that readers are really, really engaged, and I get responses, I get answers, and I have genuinely sold books because of Instagram, because people find the pictures, they find your stories, and they I guess a bit like your podcast, people start to, you know, get to know your voice, get to know your style on your stories, and they buy into you. So, yeah, I love Instagram.
Well, you definitely helped me get into it, and I love it too now. And it's funny because I feel like it's a much more personal channel. I feel like, you know, you get to share some personal things. And I'm at JF Penn Author. Who are you on Instagram?
I'm at Sasha Black Author, but Sasha with a C rather than two S's.
Yeah, there we go. So I'll put those links in the show notes. And Sasha took some lovely pictures of my books, which I put on my channel and your channel as well, right? So very, very cool. Okay, so we are out of time. So where can people find you and everything you do online?
So my website is www.sashablack.co.uk. So that was Sasha with a C. All my books are on all of the stores. I'm a wider author. And Facebook and Instagram are both at Sasha Black Author. So
fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Sasha. That was great.
Thank you for having me.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Sasha today and found some tips on writing heroes and villains. Now, next week, I have a very exciting interview for you if you enjoy my futurist segment. I'm talking about AI and creativity with Professor Marcus du Sautoy, who is awesome. And I was so thrilled to be able to talk to him. He has a book coming out next week on this very topic, and he is a maths professor at Oxford University. He is the Simonyi Professor for Science in Public or something like that. I can't remember. I give his whole title next week in the intro. But he's seriously knowledgeable and he knows a lot of the people in this space. And we both talk about AI and how it will impact us as writers. So tune in next week. Happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.